Greetings, Earth people. It's time for another edition of the Sensitive Skin Magazine podcast. I'm your host, Bernard Meisler, the editor-in-chief of Sensitive Skin Magazine. And today's guest is the always delightful Mr. John S. Hall. John is a poet and a singer, and in his spare time, he's a lawyer. He grew up in the West Village and was a big figure on the Lower East Side poetry scene at places like ABC No Rio. He started getting accompaniment to his poetry, and he ended up founding a band called King Missile, which you may remember from the 90s. They had a couple of big hits. Jesus Was Way Cool, and, of course, the classic Detachable Penis. You can find those on YouTube. If you haven't heard them, you should. So anyway, John and I had a nice conversation, and we got a little bit off track a couple of times. We started talking about politics. We started talking about veganism, and he chided me for being a meat eater. What can I say? I'm sorry. At any rate, we speak for about 45 minutes, and if you want to skip ahead at about the 45-minute mark, John sings a song called Animal Liberation. He's currently in a new reincarnation of King Missile and three other bands, Sensation Play, Unusual Squirrel, and Silk Cut. You can find all of these playing in and about New York City. So, without further ado, here's my conversation with John S. Hall. So, where did you grow up?
Where?
Yeah, where'd you grow up?
On Houston Street and 6th Avenue in Manhattan.
That must have been a hell of a time to grow up in the 70s, I'm presuming, more or less.
Hell of a makes it sound worse than it was. It was awesome. It was a great time to grow up. You know, people worry about their personal safety a lot these days.
Right.
But, you know, it's like, it's not quite as unlikely that you'll be struck by lightning as you'll be mugged. I mean, you know, it's much more likely you'll be mugged, but it's still, like, very unlikely. You know, certainly that it'll happen more than once, unless you're some sort of, like, type that attracts it. So, So I had very little, I had fear, but I had very little actual experience with violence. It wasn't scary, if that's what you're getting at. More like, the thing to really, that was more dangerous was all the temptation. A lot of things were out in the open rather than hidden. So, so I grew up with this sense that, oh, everybody does, LSD on a regular basis. You know, everybody, goes, to these strange, nightclubs and sees these bizarre performances. And everybody goes into these scary neighborhoods sometimes to see these performances and what have you. I mean, and really everybody was, you know, 25 people that I knew. You know, it wasn't everybody.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Right. And when you kind of stop doing that, some of those things anyway, you realize, oh, yeah, it wasn't really everybody. It was, just like my friends who I hung out with.
Yeah.
Most people aren't doing that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So but yeah, I mean, you know, I remember when my kid was about 2 or 3 and we got the old school Sesame Street DVDs and we put the first one in from the first episode. And you know, like the opening credits are these kids like playing in a vacant lot. And her mom didn't understand this. You would go into vacant lots and play. Yeah, you would sneak under the fence because the fence, you know, the fences were very easy to like. It's like they wanted you to sneak in, and so like, well, what was there? Well, there are bricks and broken glass and you know whatever. You know, it's like it doesn't sound like fun, but the joy of being where you weren't supposed to be. So anyway, in the opening credits of Sesame Street, they're doing this. They're like playing in this abandoned lot, and occasionally if you look at 70s films you'll see all these vacant lots and you'll see kids playing in them, and yeah, there was one of those around the corner from my house, which later became the site where they built the building that Sonia Sotomayor lived in before she became a chief justice. But yeah, it was a vacant lot.
Yeah, I mean, by the time I got to New York, which was 1984, and I was living on the Lower East Side, there were still a hell of a lot of vacant lots.
Yeah. Giuliani was only in the process of ruining things for everybody. He hadn't quite achieved it yet. And by ruining, I say, you know, many other people will say he made it so much better.
Well, it's a mixed bag, isn't it? You know, I mean, I remember when by the mid 90s, things had really started to change a lot already. By the late 90s. But I had a kid and was living in Manhattan on the Lower East Side. And I was like, we were talking about how we kind of missed the old days. But I was like, yeah, but if it was still like that, there's no way I would still be living here.
Wait, did you vote for Bloomberg?
Did I vote for Bloomberg? You know, I think I did the first time.
Yeah, I called it.
I'm going to be transparent.
This guy voted for Bloomberg.
I did not vote for Giuliani,
but you voted for
Bloomberg. No, I didn't vote. I didn't vote for Giuliani. No, but I made the mistake of voting for Bloomberg the first time.
Okay.
I'll admit it.
I mean,
I'm not politically pure.
It's not that I was politically astute. I just had a complete allergy. I've never, ever voted for a Republican ever in my life. In an early election, I remember Ed Koch ran as a Democrat and a Republican, and I didn't vote for
him
because he was nominated as a Republican. So that made him a Republican, so I didn't vote for him.
I will say it is the only time I've ever voted for a Republican, and it gives me ammunition when I get into arguments with conservative in-laws, and I can say, hey, look, I've voted for a Republican before, but, you know, this is getting out of hand, you know. So
I suppose that's helpful.
Yeah.
I look at it the other way. Anyone who's ever voted for a Republican ever is immediately suspect in my book. And I had friends in college that voted for Reagan, and I was like, fuck you all, you will see one day. And maybe they will.
Yeah.
Am I allowed to say that?
Maybe they
will. Fuck you all. I don't know what kind of podcast we have here.
Sure, you can say.
I told my kid she can listen, but she's heard me say that before. So, but maybe some of your viewers or listeners have never, ever heard that word before. So.
Oh, well, they can go fuck themselves.
Okay.
That's a problem.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's funny, though, and my daughter, I mean, I'm a lefty, basically, and it's interesting, my daughter's...
Basically?
Basically, you know, I mean,
let's find out
for Bernie Sanders.
Oh, your listeners want to know what the exceptions are. Like, what are you not lefty about?
Wow, I didn't realize we were going to take such a political turn. What am I not... what am I not lefty about?
I'm just wondering if you're going to hit the one thing that I'm not lefty about.
That's a good question. Okay. All right. I'll go there. as much as I despise the fact that the United States is an empire, I realize that there are bad actors in the world, and we do have to have some kind of military defense. I hate that we go and invade all these other countries and do all this fucked up shit all the time, but I would not want to say unilaterally disarm there. How about that? As perhaps some people do.
That's okay. That's pretty good. That's better than mine, actually.
What's yours?
I am not so sure that all property rights should be abolished.
Yeah.
I knew you were going to agree with that one, too. But
Yeah. I mean...
I say that I'm a socialist. I say, you know, that the people who have more than me should give it to the people who have less than me. I'm fine, personally, where I am.
Right.
I'd be fine with less if it meant everybody below me got more. But... But I think, I don't like wealth redistribution, and, you know, I don't like the idea that we have a system where people are, you know, where the greed of people is rewarded. I don't think that's a good system. I do think people should be able to some extent protect what they have, but I can be talked out of that opinion. I could visit a collective situation and say, oh yeah, this could work too. It just seems like,
I feel like. I feel like the wealth distribution in this. I'm all for some wealth distribution.
Why? Why?
Because I think that if you're going to have a functioning capitalist system, which we do not today.
No, I mean, no. Well, but that presumes you want a functioning capitalist system. So that would be my question. Why do you want that?
I think that it's hard to argue that the most successful countries in the world are a mix, more or less 50-50, of capitalism and socialism. Thinking of places like Denmark or Sweden or Norway.
I'm not trying to be contrary, but success can be measured in lots of different ways. And
that's true. But there's a high standard of living. Like, nobody's really too poor. People get lots of vacation time. There's universal health care.
I would put it slightly differently, but it's basically agreeing with you, which is that capitalism requires checks on wealth inequality,
exactly.
Right? It requires it.
Exactly.
Otherwise, it leads into a state that's not capitalistic at all. It's protectionist.
Exactly.
And the people with greater wealth will do whatever they can to work around a capitalist system to increase their wealth.
Right. So it basically becomes fascism, which is sort of where we're at, right? When you have oligarchs running things. But capitalism requires creative destruction, right? So if you've got like a non-functional business, you can't prop it up and keep it going. And that, of course, is what we've been doing the last 10 years or so.
I'm not sure I agree with that either. I mean, I think there are a lot of things about capitalism that need to be worked on or tweaked or fixed. And really, I think the most important thing is that people are able to survive in their communities. And if that means the government owns half of the business or a quarter of the business or all of the business, mm-hmm. I don't see why anyone should give a shit as long as people are working and are feeding themselves. Yeah. So I want the system where most people can have like the most, comfortable possible lives.
I agree 100%. Yeah. And it's an absolute scandal that, I don't know, somewhere between 25% and 50% of the people in this country, the richest society the world's ever known, are scratching by a living. Where did I see something like the bottom 50% of people in the United States could not come up with $400 in an emergency if they needed it? And meanwhile, you've got people who are buying multiple $100 million mansions and flying around in private jets. And
yeah, I mean, Matt, think about that, and we can move off of politics after this, maybe. But
okay,
so you and I are talking, right? We very easily, both of us, very easily have more money than probably 75% of the people in this country. At least certainly 50. We're in the upper half. We can go on and on and on about the upper 1%.
Let's be honest. We're top 20%ers.
I don't know. I don't know how much you make, and I don't know where the 20% mark is. But, I mean, that's probably safe to say. And my point is that, the audience that we're also trying to reach, many of them are in that bracket. People who are struggling to come up with $400 are not listening to podcasts. It's not that it's expensive. It's not like that they would necessarily be completely alienated by our discussion, but the fact is what we're doing right now is relevant to a very small select section of people that we've decided matter, that we're trying to reach with my art, with your podcast, with your publishing. And that's all really anyone can do, but it's always nice. And what we always say on the left, that seems to distinguish us from the right, is that, we don't just care about these other people to the extent that we can get their vote or get their, get something out of them, their labor or whatever. We genuinely just care because we think it's the morally right thing to do, which makes us look like pussies to the right, where it's like,
we're snowflake beta cucks and all that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what disturbs me about people on the right, and at times it's made my blood boil when talking to perhaps extended family members or childhood friends who seem to have gone off on the wrong path, is there's this lack of empathy.
Well, yeah. Just look, anyone who cites Ayn Rand as like an author or a thinker, you know, and many of them do, you know,
and many of them do,
you know, and I think everybody on the left should read a little bit of that shit so that they know exactly what they're dealing with. That's a woman who espoused a completely sociopathic and selfish outlook on life. And there's an entire political party in this country. It's the governing party that operates on that philosophy. And it's
And Paul Ryan is a big acolyte, of course. And
it's not just him, you know. And even the ones who haven't read him are still doing. I read her are doing, you know, the same kind of work.
Right. Well, there is a senator named Rand Paul, for God's sake.
Well, yeah, he's named after her. Yeah. Ron Paul was one of the first politicians that openly talked about Ayn Rand that I knew about, but she had been talked about for years, you know. I don't know that Reagan read her, but he certainly operated like someone who did. Anyone who says greed is good is, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard people say that in non-ironically.
Yeah.
Like they don't understand that, that guy was the bad guy. You don't remember that? He was like the... You didn't catch that part? Maybe you should watch that movie again. So let me ask you this question. Let's get off politics for a second, because we agree too much on most of this, I think, to have a fruitful conversation.
Yes, I did try to find some areas of difference, but they're really not there. So,
they're really not there. So when did you start writing? What made you start writing?
The usual existential crisis that a teenager goes through. If you don't really have a lot of friends, or if you have hardly any friends. So, I mean, I grew up with something of a religious background. It wasn't drilled into me, but I was brought to church every Sunday and Sunday school, and I found it interesting and I found it comforting. And when I lost the faith, I was, you know, I needed something, you know. So I think, like, the original writing that I was doing was to a god, if such a thing existed. And then at some point I realized that the act of writing gave me comfort, whether I was writing to God or not. So, you know. And then the audience became God. I mean, in a sense, and that makes sense because, like, really, you're talking to some omniscient, multi-layered or multi-personality being. So it's the same idea as, like, talking to a mass of people.
In fact, have you ever had a spiritual or mystical or religious experience during the act of writing, or experienced, like, the magic?
I mean,
sort of.
Well, I mean, I would say that it usually feels that way. I mean, writing or playing music, or even, I would say, certain kinds of consumption, like being swept away by a film, or swept away by a passionate speech, even. Or a rock performance that's, you know, particularly, or classical, whatever, your musical performances. I've had spiritual experiences in all of those environments, but writing is absolutely a timeless, infinite space of joy, I mean, for me. Today I was working on a children's story. My children's stories have changed a lot since the ones I sent you, by the way. There are 75 of them now. And
I was writing. Send them again, then.
I was writing. I was writing one today, and I missed my stop on the train. That's how lost I was in it. So.
Well, that's the best, isn't it? When you just like, when you're completely lost in the creative experience.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and so it's the own, I shouldn't say that, no, it's not. But, I mean, it's another kind of mystical experience that, you know, you can get from drugs, you can get from meditation, you can get from, from, you know, those music, et cetera.
Do you have a meditation practice?
Not currently, but I've logged many hours on the cushion, as they say. But yeah, I haven't done it in probably over a year.
Yeah, I go in and out myself. Yeah. Yeah, I get long, nice long bursts, and then I just kind of forget about it for months at a time.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a good thing.
It is.
People haven't tried it yet. They should try it. But yeah, as far as writing, I'm more of the Dorothy Parker school, in that frequently I hate writing. I find it really, really a slog a lot of times. But I enjoy having written.
Yeah, I don't think I do enjoy having written. I've thought about this a lot, that I'm kind of
perverse in that way. Complete opposites.
Well, I mean, there's something that seems kind of normal about what she's saying, but my feeling is like, where is the joy in having? It's like saying, I hate fucking, but I enjoy having fucked. That doesn't make any sense to me. You know, it's like, where's the joy in
having fucked, you lay back, you're relaxed, you know.
Oh, but she doesn't mean immediately after having written, I think. She means she enjoys the fact that she has these books on the shelf that she's written.
Maybe,
you know,
so.
It could have been 40 years ago.
Royalty checks, yeah. Enjoying the royalty checks coming in, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So I don't know.
Now I'm being a little... Yeah. I'm being a little facetious. I mean, because I guess what for me is that it sounds like it's a pretty regular experience for you. When I'm writing, it's more like, oh, God, I'm like, oh, it happened. You know, I feel like that burst of joy when all of a sudden I see some like stuff that's happened subconsciously, like all starts to like fit together. Or for instance, if I'm I've been working on a novel the last few years, and the great experience for me was just like, I was just like, you know, writing, okay, now this happened, and then whoa, I didn't see that coming. You know, the characters sort of became alive and started doing stuff of their own volition. It wasn't my idea, mm-hmm. almost, and that's just, you know, a wonderful feeling when that happens.
I mean, that always happens to me. I almost never know what's going to happen when I start writing. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what makes it such a blast.
Yeah. I think that's the key too. I think that, you know, when I started writing, I made the mistake that a lot of people do, which is like, okay, I'm writing this story, I gotta plan it out and whatever. You like they tell you to do in those screenplay books, get your index cards and write out all the scenes and you know, because you have to know where you're going. And then I realized, no, it's so much better to not know where I'm going.
Perhaps that makes sense in films because of the nature of that medium. Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, to my mind, the best approach, if I had to write a film, I would probably just write a story first, you know, and then mm-hmm. adapt the story to a screenplay. You know, so let, you know, go wild with the story, you know, and let it go wherever it's going to go. And then corral it. You know, that's what screenplay writing is very, you know, it's very much about cutting a story down to its component parts. And if you're doing that while you're trying to figure out what the story is, I think that would become very frustrating. And I think the same thing is true of a novel, too, that like maybe a good way for me, if I had to write a novel, would be to write out a 20-page outline of what happens in the novel first. Not a guide or a structure or whatever, but just really like what's going to happen, and then you stretch it out and embellish it, whatever.
Yeah, I kind of did the opposite this time, and it worked out well.
Good.
You know, it was like I had an idea. I had like
an idea
of how this story is going to kick off,
okay,
right? Like, what's the inciting incident? I guess they would call it in screenplay land, you know. And then I just sort of let it happen from there. And I would, it was a really interesting experience. I came down and just, I said, I'm going to write 1,000 words a day or more. I'm just going to go down into my office where I'm sitting talking to you now and bang out 1,000 words. And whether I feel inspired or whether I want to do it or feel like have some ideas or not, I'm just going to sit there and start, you know, like automatic typing. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I would bang out 3,000. And anyway, I knocked out the first draft of this novel in like 28 days or something mm-hmm. like that. And then, of course, it took years to,
About that national, whatever, National Novel Writing Month or whatever. You know, every November, people, like, get together mm-hmm. and they try to write a novel in the month of November. Do you know about that?
I've heard of it,
Yeah, I did that three times. I was never happy with the results, but I did manage to get the 50,000 words done in the month. And
It's totally doable.
I liked doing it. You know, again, I enjoyed writing it, but like I did not enjoy having written what I had written. And I sent it to a few people, not for publication, but for people who were extremely curious about me, because these were semi-autobiographical things. And that's really the only purpose they ended up serving, which is fine, you know. But it was a good experience to do that. And every month, every time the November rolls around, I get the emails from them. And I think, oh, do I want to do that again? And I do want to do it again. But obviously, I haven't done it this month. So maybe next year.
Yeah, I guess I haven't. I guess I haven't either. I actually wrote a complete novel that was published in 2.5 days. It's for this company called Interconnecting Media.
You wrote the novel in 2.5 days?
Yeah.
How long?
It was a pornographic novel. It was a pornographic novel.
But how long
was it? About, I don't know. Oh, it was probably about 50,000 words, something like that. Yeah, and it was ridiculous. It was just like sitting and typing. I'm going to type out 50,000 words in 3 days, and they're going to give me a check for $300. And I knew people who did that for years.
I have a friend lives across the street who did that, and he used to put his friends in it. I was in one of his porno books.
Well, that's what I did. That's pretty much what I would do too. I was just like, you know, it's basically like, what scene? I saw a movie the other day. I guess I'll like copy that scene and like, oh, there's that girl I like. I guess I'll put her in here. You know, so it's possible. It was awful though. Who are your biggest influences as far as writing? Who's like got you really excited when you were younger, or even still today, or?
You know, it's interesting. I'm trying to think of, like, whose writing do I really like to read? Allen Ginsberg is the first person that comes to mind there. But who actually inspires me as a writer? It's certain performers. So Patti Smith, mm-hmm. Jonathan Richman, mm-hmm.
Gotta love Jonathan Richman.
Johnny Cash. I realized more and more, I started listening to Johnny Cash when I was 8 or 9, and I realized more and more, there's a lot of spoken things in those records that he made in the 60s when I was listening to him, but also, like, there's a very unembellished, plain singing approach that he has. Same with Jonathan. Patti Smith is not that way. She puts what I think is very honest and real emotion into what she does. But she definitely,
so would you add Lou Reed to that list as
I
well?
I didn't really embrace Lou Reed. I'm not against him, but that is the kind of thing I'm talking about. And I also didn't really, pay that much attention to, Leonard Cohen, but I think he's great. Every song that I've encountered of his, I think, is great. And his manner of singing is very plain.
Right.
It's plainer than me. Like, I will sometimes try to do fancy things as a singer, but like, it's in my writing is that kind of approach. This kind of, like, with Patti, it's the religious stuff, really. It's like her religious inspiration. And same with Ginsberg. It's the religion. It's their sense of, like, you know, they're driven the way Blake was also, you know, by this kind of like passion for God. And probably Jonathan is too. He doesn't talk about religious things too much, but so these are all people who, and definitely Johnny Cash, very religious. So all of these people are like religious. And, you know, and then when I was a kid, also listening to Martin Luther King speak and certain other religious, even people who I thought were wrong, just the way they embraced, like, the, like, it's a passive thing where you're kind of allowing yourself to be invaded by a spirit and having it operate through you. A.R. Ammons is another one, and that's an obscure name, so I'll talk about that. I went up to Cornell for a six-week pop songwriting class, and it was canceled when I got there, so I just arbitrarily chose verse writing, and it was taught by a guy named A.R. Ammons, who's kind of out of the Whitman School, and I loved his poetry, and I loved that class, and that really inspired me to write about whatever I wanted to write about in whatever way. He has a poem called, I think it's called Poetics, about just sort of finding the form that the thing you're writing about wants to be in, and then just going with that, you know.
That does sound vaguely familiar, but was this before or after King Missile, or during?
It was before.
Before?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I had had a band called You Suck before that.
And such a great name for a band.
Yeah, well, that was like a bad cover band, and the songs were terrible. And this was the thing. I wanted to be a songwriter, and I just never wrote songs that I liked. I hated all of my songs. Dog Bowl has, you know, when I started working with Dog Bowl, he particularly liked one of my songs that I think is awful. We've always fought about, like, this is not a good song, you know. And, you know, now that I'm, like, 107 years old, I can look back and see what he saw in the song. But now, finally, I picked up an instrument last August, and now I know, like, probably 30 or 40, yeah, maybe 30 chords. So, and how they fit together usually. And so I can write songs, that I like, somehow, like, the lyrics have gotten more acceptable to me now that I'm writing the music too.
Mm-hmm. So, what was your process before? Were you basically just writing poetry and Dog Bowl would put it to music, or?
Yeah. And most of these things didn't rhyme, you know. Now I write a lot more rhyming stuff. Because I've got the instrument right there, and I've got the melody in my head, so I'm writing to a melody. But yeah.
What instrument are you playing?
Ukulele.
Guitar? Ukulele, okay.
Yeah, I'll show it to you. It's right here. I thought originally I would just use the ukulele to learn how to write songs. But I wouldn't perform, but now I perform with it too. It's a Les Paul. Like that, yeah. So anyway, if your viewers want to know what it looks like, you can Google Les Paul ukulele, although there are two kinds. Mine is the one that looks slightly less cool.
Yes. Is it what size is it? I know a little bit about ukuleles.
It's a
little ones, medium ones, big ones.
Yeah, it's a medium one. It's a concert. I think that's the one between soprano and tenor.
Okay. So. Did you ever see that George Harrison documentary made by Martin Scorsese a few years ago?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, do you remember this? I love that story where he told, I think it was like Eric Clapton said he went to George Harrison's house, and George was like, come on, let's play ukuleles. And they like, yeah, okay, and they played ukuleles for a while. And then Clapton was leaving, and he's like, do you have, and George was like, do you have a ukulele? He's like, no, I've never played one before. And he opened up the trunk of his Rolls Royce.
Yes.
Filled with ukuleles. I said, here you go, man. Everybody's got to have a ukulele.
Yeah. Well, they're very cheap. They're very easy to play. And and you can write songs that you can then show to guitarists, and then they can make it sound good. You know?
Yeah, and it's also, it's interesting. It's become a popular instrument in the last number of years, I guess, too, last 10 years or so.
Yeah, I'm disappointed about that, that I'm doing something that's trendy and popular. That wasn't my intention.
Right.
I just suddenly I suddenly just got fed up with myself having to always like drag musicians in to write music for stuff. I was like, I think I can probably do this. And now I do. Like, oh, okay, so I have this friend, Susan Huang. She's in two of my bands. And she also has this thing called the Bushwick Book Club, where they assign you a book, and then you have to write a song about the book and then perform it within the month, right? So I've done this maybe 14 times, and the last maybe six of them, I've written the words and the music, not just the music. Maybe more like seven or eight. And this is really what got me starting to write songs. I don't think I've told Susan this, but like, that's what made me say, you know what, if I'm going to keep doing this, I can't keep asking people to come all the way out to this place way out in Brooklyn and play for no money. I don't mind playing for no money, but I don't like to have other people playing for no money. So I was like, I got myself a ukulele, and really, like, I can't remember the last time I bought something for myself that I feel better about. You know, I don't really like to buy things, and
it's hard, the consumerist society we live in that tells you that that's the source of happiness. But I think that's the you can't go wrong spending money on musical instruments.
I'm sure I could if I really got into it. I keep looking at, oh, do I want another ukulele? Do I want a guitar? Do I want a baritone ukulele, which is like a four-string guitar? What do I want? You know, and I was like, you know what? There's still so much on this that I don't know how to do, and I could keep working on this. So
yeah, I don't know. We have my kids both play music, and my wife used to be a musician. Interesting, she doesn't know you. I was like, John Hall, you don't know him? She's like, yeah, I don't know. I guess you were in different circles. But
who is she? Do I know her?
Jenny Wade.
No, I don't.
She played with. Her claim to fame was she was in the Swans for a little while.
I saw the Swans. I think Missile played with the Swans once at CB's.
Go.
I think we did.
Oh, okay.
That might be wrong. That might be misremembering. But yeah,
early '90s.
I know. I saw.
She was more in like the Timber, Vodka, Rude Buddha. Those were her bands. But so anyway, we got all these guitars and stuff, and I like to play guitar, and even though I'm terrible at it.
Yeah.
It's like one of those things you can be like, you know, I shouldn't say I'm terrible. I'm utterly mediocre. And I've been doing it for years and like barely know the rudiments of musical theory and scales and stuff like that. But it's fun. It's fun to put on a record and, you know,
yeah,
play along with it. It's nothing more fun, right?
Yeah.
So you're in, you said two bands. I know one band is Unusual Squirrel. What's the other band?
No, I'm in four bands. But Susan is in two of those four bands.
Okay, so let me ask you. You were, after King Missile broke up, which I'm assuming...
No, King Missile counts as one of the bands. We're going to play in January.
So King Missile's still going.
Yeah.
But you stopped for a long time,
yeah,
didn't you?
Yeah. I mean, I had a period where I wasn't writing or performing. I was just eating, really. I don't know what I was doing. I wasn't doing much.
Yeah, I mean, I had the same thing. It's just like when I had... Basically, I stopped writing and being involved in the literary scene and publishing and all that when my kid was born. I was just like, I got to go to work. I got, you know, I got these people who depend on me to, you know, put food on the table. And so I took a good long break. I didn't do anything for about 12 years and started again about 2010. And it was a really good thing to do. It felt really good. But somehow, you know, the circumstances of my life were, I felt like, hey, it's kind of interesting. All my friends, really, all my closest friends are still artists or writers or painters or whatever. And I don't know. And, you know, I had a little health scare or whatever. And I was like, what is the meaning of all this stuff? I've got this so-called career. I've been working as a computer programmer, web developer for years, which I'm just about fucking done with because I fucking hate that world so much at this point, for so many obvious reasons. When I started doing this stuff in the 90s, it was like, I was playing, you know, I was like working with people who, everybody who was doing it was like an artist, pretty much, you know. It was like when the web stuff started, and, you know, I was playing, like I worked with like the drummer in John Zorn's band, and that was just very common. And now the...
Not, you don't mean people who were doing this. Which drummer? Was it Laura?
Ted Epstein?
Oh, I don't know him.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, now the people who are doing this today are kids who've been like on the internet since they were like 8 years old.
Yeah. And they're less interesting.
They're very uninteresting. It's not even less interesting. I hate to say it, they're nerds, you know? I used to say I was a geek, but not a nerd. A fine point of distinction there. But I mean, you know, there's, man, it's just like these kids are telling me, and there's and they're so young, so many of them. And I was like eating lunch with some of these guys, and they tell me, oh yeah, you know, I love science fiction movies. And I was like, yeah, you hear the new Blade Runner movie's coming out? Just a couple of years ago. And they're like, Blade Runner, what's that? Yeah, you're saying you're a big science fiction fan and you'd not heard of Blade Runner. And these are smart people.
I just showed my kid Close Encounters last week. She liked it a lot. She's 12.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a couple more years, you can show her Starship Troopers. Or maybe, yeah. One of the great science fiction movies of all time.
I like Starship Troopers, but... but she would not. She doesn't like bugs.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's the bug thing. That's a problem.
Yeah. I won't show her the new King Kong for the same reason. Or new. It's not that new anymore, but, you know, the remake. The second remake. Have you ever seen the third remake. Have you ever seen the second remake? Or the first remake of the 1976 version where he climbs the World Trade Center?
Yes, I have. And I will correct you in saying that's not the second remake.
That's the first
you're
remake.
Forgetting
yeah,
the first, but the, you're forgetting the Japanese monster movie versions of King Kong. Do you remember?
Yes, I am forgetting them. Do they count?
There was a King Kong versus Godzilla, King Kong versus Frankenstein, and
that's not a remake. That's a sequel.
That's true. You're absolutely right. It's a spin-off or whatever. I remember watching those when I was a kid. And it's like, what? That's not Frankenstein. King Kong. Why does King Kong look all fucked up, man? That's not right. But yes, I do remember the 76 version with Jeff Bridges.
Yeah.
And Jessica Lange. Yeah. Jeff Bridges and Jessica Lange. Yeah.
I watched it 2 years ago, I think, and that was just amazing.
Amazingly bad, right?
Well, I mean, it's amazing because, you know, the last 20 minutes of it, you know, it is the greatest use of the World Trade Center in cinema. Unless you count 9/11.
Whoa.
You know, I mean, which is very compelling.
Or the guy who did the tightrope between them was pretty cool.
Well, I saw that as it happened, and I wouldn't put it there. Now someone made a narrative movie of that. That's probably worth doing. Was it Zemeckis?
Right.
It might have been Zemeckis.
I'm not sure,
but
yeah, there was a documentary that was, it was interesting, you know, about how he like snuck in there and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And, but I think 9/11 was probably more spectacular.
You know, I
dark sense of the word.
I VCR'd the television that day. And I remember 2 years later watching it. And that's what I mean. It was really compelling to watch. You know, you know, people never do that. It would, you know, and I think they should, you know, watch live television, live unfolding of tragic events. Like, or even like the Trump election. Could you imagine watching the election returns now?
Oh, my
God. I'm reliving. Oh, God. I mean, it would be compelling viewing. Wouldn't it? You know?
Yeah.
But nobody does
that.
Or the Bush, you know?
The Bush Gore election.
There you
election.
Go. That too, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think about this a lot that, like, you know, I'll go and see movies, right? But then, like, the real, you know, like, but then some, if I rewatch live television of, like, really pivotal events, it can be as compelling, if not more so, than some like amazingly well done narrative movies. But people don't do that. People watch documentaries, but compared to a documentary, the actual live footage, you could edit it a little bit, but like, it would just be an amazing thing to watch.
Yeah, I can't even watch that stuff though. Like whenever it's the anniversary and they show the play, I have to like close my eyes. I just can't even. Kicks up my PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
And all that. Maybe I should call Dr. Steve about this. I don't know.
Were you there?
I lived about a mile away.
Mm-hmm.
So okay, yeah. Was, you know.
Yeah, I lived about hearing it 3 miles away. Yeah.
Yeah, I was on 6th Street and 2nd Avenue at the time.
So. Oh, that's not a mile away. That's like
three. Isn't that about a mile?
That's about 3 miles away. That's where I was. I mean, okay. I was on Houston Street, and about 5 blocks from where I grew up is where I was.
It felt pretty fucking close at the time.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And then they cordoned off Manhattan at 14th Street, which is like this. Talk about, like, be careful what you wish for. You know, it's like, nobody's allowed below 14th Street unless they can show that they live here. And I was like, wow, this is kind of awesome. It's too bad, you know, the circumstances are unfortunate.
There was this place across the street from where I lived, and it was like one of these touristy places that only bridge and tunnel people came to. And it was one of the few businesses that was open, you know, on September 12th, but nobody was in there because nobody from the neighborhood ever went there. And I was like, and right. They looked surprised. And I was like, did you guys never realize that like nobody,
yeah.
You're not a neighborhood place. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was kind of refreshing in a strange, horrible way. It was like, there's only people from the neighborhood were in the neighborhood for a week or so. And it was kind of like it was back in, you know, the '80s again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's because I mean, the '80s people out, not too many people. I mean, when I first moved to New York, this was like one of the first things somebody says, don't go east of First Avenue. And I was like, oh, I got to go east of First Avenue, see what's going on over there that they're, you know, warning me about. And there were not a lot of bridge and tunnel people coming to the Lower East Side back then.
That's true.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, do you want to read something for us or play something on your ukulele or?
Sure. Can it be fucked up? Oh, no, it can't, because maybe my kid will listen. Oh, all right, I'm going to do this one. She likes this song, okay? This is one of the Bushwick Book Club songs. But I think I have to put this down while I'm doing it. So you can't see me doing this. Is that all right? Is that all right? So,
yeah, it's fine.
So the last Bushwick Book Club was for Animal Farm. And I decided to write about the beginning of Animal Farm where they're talking about the revolution. And so so I named the song after a different animal book, Animal Liberation, which is a Peter Singer book, which I have not read, but it was one of the first animal rights books. But I thought it was a good name for a song. So this is my Bushwick Book Club song. It's called Animal Liberation. Non-human animals, let's contemplate our hopeless future, our horrible fate. We work to the last atom of our strength. To win our freedom, we must go to any length. How we pray for our liberation. No more human beings, an entire animal nation. Animal liberation, animal liberation now. I messed up. So long as human beings walk the earth, the rest of us animals will have no words. Every law of nature the humans distort. Our lives are miserable, laborious and short. How we pray for liberation, not just a farm, an entire animal nation. Animal liberation, animal liberation. The life of an animal is slavery, sorry. And when our usefulness ends, then so must we. Slaughtered and butchered with hideous cruelty. And they cook and eat our flesh, yes, that's our destiny. Humans consume, they never produce. They can't make anything, no eggs, no milk, no juice. Too weak to pull the plow, too slow to catch rabbits. Lying, cheating, stealing, thieving. Exploiting are just a few of their bad habits. The ground is fertile and the climate is good, yet we don't benefit from it the way we should. Our labor is stolen from us by the human race. Where in our evolution comes, we'll put them in our native place. How we pray for our liberation, not just an entire animal world, not just an animal nation. Animal liberation, animal liberation now. Animal liberation now.
That's the song. I should have said that some of the lines from the song are taken straight out of the book. So, like, I wouldn't normally say, you know, we work to the last atom of our strength, but that's a quote from the book itself. So, and there are a few of them in there. So, yeah, it was fun to write. My kid likes it because she's vegetarian and I'm vegan.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been vegan?
Almost 20 years.
That's great.
Yeah, you know. I personally think it's morally wrong to eat animals. I try not to judge others, and sometimes I fail.
Yeah, I agree, and I'm a failed vegetarian. You know, I say I'm a vegetarian except at mealtimes.
Mm. I'm sure all the animals laugh at that while you're eating them.
Oh, I do try to give thanks to the animal before I eat them. For whatever that's worth.
Trying to imagine if, like, there were a race of carnivores and they thanked me before eating me, whether I would appreciate that. Maybe I would.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe
I would. Yeah. Well, you know, I feel like,
all right,
yeah, eventually probably will stop, at least for a while. Many people will stop.
I think so. Well, I think we're going to not have so much of a choice about it over the next 20 years or so.
Yeah. There's that too.
You know, there's a massive cause of, I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but apparently it's one of the main causes of global warming, climate change.
No, it's not ridiculous. What's ridiculous
is animal flatulence, cattle flatulence.
What's ridiculous is that a lot of environmentalists don't like to talk about how bad farming is for the environment because they think they will lose some large amount of their constituency if they talk about that. But yeah, it's bad news.
And it's well, I mean,
that's not
kudos
my concern. However, I always say I would not eat animals even if it was worse for the environment, because I just think it's cruel to the animals. But the environmental argument does exist. Yeah, I just don't find it
for whatever it's worth. If this will help me to get into the good place instead of the bad place, it's like I do eat when I do eat meat. It's grass fed, free range, non-penned up stuff. I don't know.
Always?
I try.
See, it seems to me, like, I'm very lazy. Like, if I had a choice between doing that and just not eating meat at all, it's easier just to not eat meat than to, like, make sure I know where all my meat is coming from. I mean, it seems like an awful lot of trouble to go to when it would be easier to just not eat it at all. But, you know, whatever. People do what they do.
I've tried, and it just, for my physiology, my Ayurvedic body type, if you will, it didn't quite work. I was hungry all the time.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know about the Ayurvedic body types? There's like...
No, but yeah, it's basically, I don't give a shit about... types. I don't give a shit about any philosophy that tells people it's okay to eat meat, because I think it's a bullshit philosophy, personally. It's just not okay. But, I mean... You know, there are some people that are allergic to soy and wheat and the rest of it, and maybe that's true, you know, but, I mean, we were born as omnivores, which means we have a choice.
Right. Right. Well, that is part of the problem for me. I can't eat soy or wheat. Those are both really bad for me.
Yeah.
I get inflamed and all that shit, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so then if I put myself in those shoes... It would be more tempting for me to eat meat. I still don't think I'd do it, but I don't know. You know, if a doctor said you can't eat soy or wheat, I don't know. Maybe I'd start eating eggs. Yeah. I don't know.
So you're really strict vegan? No.
Oh yeah, yeah.
No
yeah.
dairy, no yeah. eggs, nothing. Yeah.
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 But yeah, I might just rely heavily on eggs, but I wouldn't be happy about it. But, like, eggs seem a little bit not as bad as milk to me, which I also...
Well, milk is just disgusting.
Yeah, it seems like a bad idea, and the way we get it is bad, so... But eggs, theoretically, you know, I could get eggs from a place that doesn't, like, make chickens' lives miserable. Most of them do, but right. some don't.
Right, most of them do. They actually just passed the... law in California.
Yeah, I know about that. Law.
Like the yeah. little chicken coop things. Yeah.
Yeah.
What was I going to say? I don't know.
Now your listeners all think I'm an asshole, but I am. When it comes to being a vegan,
I appreciate.
I've decided I'm going to become more and more of an asshole about it. I'm an asshole about Republicans, so why shouldn't I be an asshole about carnivores too? Fuck them.
there you go. I think of like Donald Trump, like whose favorite meal is like burnt steaks with ketchup.
Yeah.
On them, and that's tells you everything you need to know about the guy in a nutshell.
Yeah.
I think.
I'm going to say this. I'm going to say all steaks are Trump steaks.
All steaks are Trump steaks.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I can see that.
Yeah. It's not true. It's not true. Otherwise,
and that was one of his things,
yes.
right? Trump
yes,
steaks,
Trump.
Late night TV, Trump steaks. Good fucking God. What has happened? Did you ever hear about the particle accelerator? The Hadron particle accelerator that they started in CERN, Switzerland.
Yeah, I have a friend across the street who works on that. He's a physicist.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there was actual concern when they were about to turn it on, which was just a little over 10 years ago,
yes.
that it would destroy the fabric of the universe. My latest working theory is that it did. It destroyed the last 10 years. We've split off into some dark timeline.
Because in 1980, when we elected Reagan, that was fine?
Yeah, that wasn't so great. Those were tough. Those were tough years. You know, I'm very pleased with I was saying earlier, so I'm basically a lefty, and then we went off on the long tangent, but I was meaning to say my daughter is so far to the left of me.
Really?
That it's kind of great.
Does she eat meat?
Not very much.
I'll bet she stopped.
Both my daughters.
I'll bet she stopped.
Both my daughters did the vegetarian thing for a while.
Yeah.
And again, found it difficult for them. But she's like, socialism.
What do you mean?
Right there.
Do you get like serious stomach problems, or
do I get serious stomach problems?
I mean, what does difficult mean? I'm wondering what's difficult about it.
Well.
I mean, I'm blessed with a fairly.
I'll say it the other way around. Is that like wheat and grains are really bad for people.
Okay, fair enough.
So
yeah.
And my oldest daughter was vegetarian for a couple of years when she was in high school, and she missed turkey sandwiches too badly. She couldn't take it anymore. She had to have a turkey sandwich.
Yeah, my kid's been vegetarian, I feel like 5 years now. She's 12. I think 5 years, and she's 12.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Like, I have nothing but admiration for you, because, again, there's so many.
It wasn't me. She said she wanted to do it, and I was like, okay.
Right. I mean, it's, I like to think of myself as an environmentalist, but, yeah, here I am eating meat, but we do what we can do. I put solar panels up on my house as soon as I got a house, even though it wasn't financially a great idea, but I was like, I don't care. I don't want to be responsible for burning all these fossil fuels and, we do it.
I'm sure you're much better for the environment than I am, but actually that's not true, because eating meat actually probably outweighs almost everything good you can do for the environment. I think that's right. Yeah, I think I read that somewhere. Every time I don't recycle, I can think to myself, you know what? But I don't eat meat, so I'm way ahead of most of y'all recycling people. That would be a way to sell it to people. It's like, do you realize that if you stop eating meat, you wouldn't have to recycle anything, and you'd still be doing more for the environment than people eat and recycle.
It'll be like when you go visit Texas or Georgia, and everybody just throws all their shit into the same garbage bag, and you're like, wow, look at that.
But they also eat newspapers. But if everyone in Texas didn't eat meat but kept doing that shit with their garbage, be much better for the environment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, if you wanted to say to Texas what you could do for the environment, start recycling or stop eating meat. Stop eating meat. Much better for the environment. Yeah.
I unfortunately have a feeling that message wouldn't go over so well in Texas.
But anyway, that's my point. To everybody out there who feels guilty about not recycling, if you stop eating meat, you can stop feeling guilty about not recycling.
All right, you heard it here from John S. Hall. Just throw all your shit in the same bag and don't eat meat, and you're ahead of the game.
You are. You'll go to the good place, the real good place.
But yeah, a good friend of mine works for the NRDC, and he visited Al Gore's house, and...
Is Al Gore vegan?
Probably not.
I need to Google that shit immediately.
Yeah, but he lives in a 10,000 square foot house, with all the lights on all the time, and he flies around in private jets.
Oh, then he must be vegan.
Yeah, I don't know if the veganism could make up for the private jet thing. I don't know.
That's how he sleeps at night. He's like, recycling is for carnivores.
Yeah, he sleeps at night the same way we all do, right? We all have our foibles or whatever that we're we're in denial about, and none of us are saints, John, as you know.
I am certainly not a saint. I don't know if you heard, but I don't actually diligently recycle. I recycle, but I'm not diligent about it.
Yeah, it's confusing here.
The recycling police came and looked. They would find plastic in my, whatever. I was like, well, I didn't want to wash it, so I just put it in the garbage.
Yeah, here, you know. Well, there you go too. It's just like, should I waste the we're in a constant state of drought here. Should I waste the amount? How much water am I wasting to, like, you know, clean out this little tin of cat food or whatever? Is it, you know, what's the plus minus here?
There you go.
I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, I guess it's time to wrap up. To keep this within our time bounds. And I don't know, is there anything else you wanted to say or talk about?
I will say that I have four groups. King Missile.
Okay.
Sensation Play, that's the male sexual submission band. Oh, sorry, Violet. That's my kid, if she's listening. And then there's Unusual Squirrel, which is like kind of like an acoustic-y kind of King Missile thing. And then I have this thing called Silk Cut, which is me and R.B. Corbett for now, and we'll probably end up add a percussionist soon. All four of them are active. Three of those four have shows coming up in the next 2 months. And the fourth one will probably also have a show sometime next year, soon.
And are you just playing around the city, or are you doing any tours anytime?
Oh, nobody cares. Yeah, so we'll just play in the city.
Yeah, okay.
But
I will try to catch you the next time I'm in town.
Okay, and I'll send you some of the kids' stories. They're more enjoyable. Like, you know, I was in this one kind of mindset when I wrote the first set, and I've broken out of that a lot. So,
all right. Yeah, I look forward to seeing them.
Okay, take care.
All right.
Bye.
You too.